From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Ali Soufan, CEO of the Soufan Group, an international strategic consulting firm based in New York City, and we're coming to you from his office here in New York City. Ali is no stranger to these VOA microphones. We've interviewed him on numerous occasions on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. We discussed his acclaimed book, The Anatomy of Terror, From the Death of Bin Laden to the Rise of the Islamic State, on our show last year. This time, we want to discuss a range of domestic and foreign policy issues, both emanating from and bedeviling the Trump administration. We'll ask Ali Soufan for his take on former FBI Director James Comey's explosive new memoir, A Higher Loyalty. As a former supervisory FBI agent, Ali Soufan knows America's premier law enforcement agency very well. He investigated and supervised sensitive and highly complex terrorism cases, including the East Africa embassy bombings, the attack on the USS Cole, and the events surrounding the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. A native of Lebanon, Ali Soufan was one of only a handful of FBI agents who spoke Arabic following the 9/11 attacks. A popular TV drama series, The Looming Tower, which reenacts the events leading up to the terror attacks, is based on Soufan's time in the FBI. In 2011, he published a memoir entitled The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda, which contains historical background on Al-Qaeda. Notwithstanding inroads made to degrade Al-Qaeda, Ali Soufan says that bin Laden's message still resonates and Al-Qaeda's affiliates are more powerful, widespread, and better equipped than ever. Washington, Baghdad, and other allies may be eroding the so-called Islamic State, Al-Qaeda's most brutal spin-off, but Al-Qaeda still remains a threat. Ali Soufan, welcome to the program.
Nice to see you again, Carol. Always a pleasure.
Well, Ali, let's start with the book by former FBI Director James Comey. It's called A Higher Loyalty. He's been on the interview circuit. And I'm just reminding our listeners that 1 year ago, President Donald Trump fired James Comey, the FBI director, allegedly for mishandling the case concerning Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server, but later admitted in a televised interview that he wanted to be rid of the person, that is James Comey, sure, who was investigating Russia's interference in the U.S. election and possible ties between the Trump campaign and Moscow. So we all know that Mr. Comey presents a rather harsh assessment of the president, saying he doesn't tell the truth. He compares him actually even to a mafia boss because the mafia bosses want loyalty, as he said, allegedly, he wanted from James Comey. So your take on Comey's rendition?
First of all, James Comey is an honorable man. James Comey is a man that spent his life in public service. He was a prosecutor. He became the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. He then became a Deputy Attorney General. And during his time as a prosecutor, as a United States Attorney, and as a Deputy Attorney General, he always did the right thing. He always stood up to power because of what he believed the Constitution and the laws of the United States are telling us to do. And his stand, for example, against the Bush administration with the unwarranted surveillance issue can speak a ton about the character of James Comey. I believe Director Comey, he thinks what he's doing today is part of his oath to defend the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And there is an individual who had the opportunity to see what he is telling us firsthand. And I truly believe that he thinks it is his role, it is his duty to tell the American people his assessment of the current president of the United States. And he has the right to do so. I think it is shocking that the president attacks him for expressing his views and his opinions and tweet against him and not answer the allegations that, Mr. Comey is putting forward about the president and about what he believes the president is doing today.
And some critics also say that President Trump is not only attacking James Comey, the person, but he is attacking and undermining the institution that is the FBI.
Absolutely. I mean, look at it. He's attacking Comey, but then he's attacking McCabe, but then he's attacking the FBI and saying how the FBI is in, I forget the term that he used, that the FBI is in shattered or something, the term that he used at one point. But then he attacked his own attorney general. He attacked his own deputy attorney general. So he's attacking the Department of Justice. He's attacking anyone who does not have 100% loyalty to the president. And this is really scary. We're not Turkey, with all due respect. We're not Russia. We're the United States of America. And you have a president who appointed the deputy attorney general, who appointed the attorney general, who was one of the very first supporters of candidate Trump when he was in the Senate.
Jeff Sessions.
Jeff Sessions. And he's attacking them now because he believes that they are not treating him fairly.
Are you concerned about the morale within the FBI, even though you're no longer part of the FBI? I'm sure you have many contacts, friends, colleagues. What is the mood?
Look, you know, a lot of people in the Bureau, they really like James Comey, and they think James Comey was a good director. And I think all the attacks against the institution, against the men and women of the FBI, against the leadership of the FBI, you know, will have an impact on so many people. But I think I know my organization very well. And the men and women of the FBI took an oath to defend this country, this constitution, the laws of this country, and they will continue to do so. This is not the first time the FBI is attacked, and I don't think it will be the last. I think it's a difficult period we're going through, but these people, you know, in the Bureau will continue to do their job alongside their colleagues in the intelligence community. And towards the end, the American people, because of their efforts, will know the truth.
Ali, let me turn to the experience you had when you were with the FBI and the lead up to the 9/11 attacks on U.S. soil. At the time, you were one of the first people who expressed concern that the CIA at the time wasn't sharing intelligence with the FBI. That may have even possibly led to or was one of the factors that prompted the 9/11 attack, that is, the lack of the sharing of intelligence. How do you see now, so many years later, are we connecting the dots as we were supposed to have done after that terrible attack, sharing information, etc.?
Well, what I said back then was also the conclusion of the 9/11 Commission and also the conclusion of the CIA's own Inspector General report. So this is basically part of history at this point. But I think after 9/11, the situation became a lot better, and we have very close relationship between the intelligence agencies, and they are working effectively together. But there are a lot of things, you know, in a way remind us of what happened before 9/11. You have a situation here where the entire intelligence community of the United States, 17 different intelligence agencies, saying that Russia interfered in our election, and you have the commander-in-chief saying no. Just, a month or so ago, you had the head of all the main intelligence agencies in the United States, the FBI, the CIA, the DNI, the NSA. They were sitting next to each other, and each and every one of them said they did not get any directive from the president to respond against Russia's interference. That reminded me with what was happening at the time when, you know, we were saying that Al-Qaeda is a threat, that bin Laden is going to hit, that there is a threat called terrorism, and everyone was concern about a stain on a blue dress. And I think in so many ways, history is repeating itself. It's not the intelligence community are not talking to each other. They are. They are giving us everything that we need to know. The problem is the political leadership is not taking that threat seriously. And this is unfortunately where we stand today. You have every head of main intelligence agency in America, to include the FBI, to include the CIA, to include the DNI, to include the NSA, basically in front of Congress saying, yes, Russia is a big threat. Yes, Russia interfered in our election. Yes, Russia is planning to interfere in the 2018 election. But at the same time, they did not get any directive from the United States to counterattack. Look, we have the best intelligence agencies in the world. We have the smartest people. I am sure that they have way more information than anyone in the media or any of us have. We don't have rogue intelligence agencies. You know, if the CIA wanted to counterattack Russia, okay, they need a directive from the president of the United States. If the NSA wanted to retaliate for the Russia disinformation, They need a directive from the President of the United States. Unfortunately, as we've seen, all the head of different agencies said the President did not give them a directive to do so. I can guarantee you, if the CIA wanted to do a campaign similar to what the Russians did here, you will have demonstrations in Moscow in less than a few weeks. But we're not getting directives to retaliate, unfortunately.
Well, exactly. You really put your finger on a very important issue, which is the divide between President Trump and the national security team. Even his own ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said that we were putting sanctions on Russia, and then Mr. Trump walked that back. To what extent is this dangerous to have this divide between, you know, the President of the United States and his team? What kind of message does that send, not only to the Russians, but to our allies?
Very negative message. You know, you're spot on. I mean, you know, you have allies that already worried about the actions of the president, and now they see that even, you know, his representative in the United Nations does not agree with him on issues, or he doesn't agree with her on issues. You see that the president attacking publicly his own attorney general and his own deputy attorney general. Sometimes he criticizes even his own FBI director. This is very concerning. And, you know, when you're dealing with allies in Europe and all the problems that they are having with the Russians and the disinformation campaign in Europe, or the expansion of China in the South China Sea and in Asia, when you're dealing with situation in Syria, you know, it makes our allies very concerned about how serious and how dependable the United States is.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Ali Soufan, former supervisory FBI agent and acclaimed author and CEO of the Soufan Group. That's a strategic intelligence consultancy based here in New York City. And we're coming to you from the Soufan Group headquarters in Manhattan. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Razan Nazal from Amman, Jordan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please write to us at PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And we do want to hear from you. Please tell us what insights you may have gleaned from our conversation with Ali Soufan. And back now to our special guest, Ali Soufan. Let's continue our conversation about Russia's nefarious activities, whether here in the United States, whether in Europe, whether in Syria. But I want to go back to the United States for a moment, Ali Soufan, because right here in the United States, we have homegrown terrorism. We have terrorism from the far right, now called the so-called alt-right. We have white supremacist groups on the rise, and we're just basically commemorating the 23rd anniversary of the very tragic Oklahoma City bombing on a federal building. This wasn't until 9/11, of course, the worst terrorist attack on U.S. soil. So notwithstanding the threats that you've written about so eloquently, Al-Qaeda and other Islamist extremist groups, how would you assess the far-right movement here in the United States? To what extent does it pose as much as, if not more, of a threat to our values and country?
Well, the alt-right movement today, what they call the so-called alt-right movement, I mean, it's basically a bunch of racist people. Let's call it what it is. You can put a lipstick on a pig, but it will continue to be a pig. But that also goes with what we see today. You know, we see a rise of anti-Semitism, we see a rise of hate, we see a rise of racism, we see a rise of blaming the others for the problem that we have in America. And I think we see a rise in fascist and in white supremacist organizations and militias in the United States. And this is a fact that the intelligence community and the law enforcement community are dealing with. And I think the rise is not only because these organizations now are popular. The rise is because the power of these organizations have been inflated by Russia and by Russian bots. And if you see the leaders of the ultra-right movement in America, people like David Duke or people like Richard Spencer, people even like Alex Jones. All these individuals are so much in love with Putin and in love with Russia, and they are connected in a way or another to Russia. They consider Russia our friend. So I think we have to put all these things in context when we see individuals and people and group, not only in the United States, but also in the UK and in Hungary and in Poland, who don't believe in Western liberalism, who don't believe in multiculturalism, but in the same time, they look at Russia and they think of it as a mythical homeland for white people. And they look at Putin and they look at him as a champion of the war against Western liberalism and multiculturalism. And definitely, they're going to be used by Russia. But let's be clear. I mean, Russia, what they are doing today, they are not planting the seed of discord. They are not creating strife in our society. But I believe they are rather providing fertilizers and sunlight to an already existing bitter crop. And that's what we're witnessing today.
Exactly. We've always known that these groups exist here in the United States by virtue of what I just said earlier with the Oklahoma City bombing. We've had so many incidents up until now. But some critics are saying perhaps the rhetoric emanating from the president himself, who is well known for the anti-immigrant sentiment, for xenophobic rhetoric, and for his reluctance to call Russia out, call Mr. Putin out in particular, and really his reluctance to call out these so-called white supremacists. We recall the terrible events in Charlottesville last August when we had the white supremacists facing off a group of protesters who wanted to protest the existence of Confederate statues. They were peaceful, but they were met by these violent white supremacists. And Mr. Trump famously said there's fault on both sides.
Yeah.
Again, I wonder to what extent this also adds fuel to the fire or fertilizer to these movements.
You know, the rhetoric of President Trump and candidate Trump definitely, you know, fueled these organizations. I mean, do you remember, for example, when people like Alex Jones, people like Richard Spencer, people like David Duke, friends with Russia, and they are considered leaders in the ultra-right movement. You know, unfortunately, the rhetoric of President Trump is definitely leading to it. The rhetoric of candidate Trump gave the seed not only fertilizers and sunlight, but the much needed water to grow. I don't know how the president feel about racism or about anti-Semitism or about all these emotional reactions that the ultra-right movement have to different issues. I don't know if he shared these things with them, but definitely he's using it for his own political career. So I don't know what's in his heart, but I see what's in his action. And definitely his actions is giving a lot of space for these organizations to operate and bringing them more and more towards the mainstream, unfortunately.
Indeed. And just to wrap up quickly, circling back to what you said about Russia, your organization, the Sufan Group, demonstrated that there are ties between Moscow and these groups, whether through back channels, even through the National Rifle Association, we understand. And so this is something that we need to be concerned about, I think, here in America.
Not only in the United States, but also in Europe. Again, not only social media, but also physical support to racist organizations in the UK or in Poland or in the Ukraine or in Hungary, France, for example.
Oh, absolutely.
The Russians openly supported Le Pen. So you have a lot of connections going on. A lot of these connections are happening in plain sight. Le Pen supported by Putin, and then you have
money given to her.
Bannon going and basically campaigning for Le Pen recently in France and saying, you know, use racism and xenophobia as a badge of honor.
Yes. Now let's remind our listeners, Steve Bannon was the previous chief strategist of Mr. Trump.
So there is a lot of interconnections here that we're already seeing it in plain sight. And I'm sure Director Mueller will be looking at all these things in his obstruction of justice case or collusion case.
Right.
That he's building against the Trump campaign.
Right. Robert Mueller, the special counsel whom Mr. Trump has threatened on many occasions to fire or try to fire.
Another indication. another indication how he has no respect for the rule of law. You know, the deep state. Who says deep state in America? I mean, this is the biggest insult to the institutions that we have.
Indeed. Well, the deep state, yes, these words are thrown around, and we have a bureaucracy, we have institutions here in the United States, and I think those of us who do work for the government might take umbrage at this type of characterization. Nobody's perfect. Bureaucracies have flaws, but it is disconcerting to hear these kinds of words being thrown around. We shall see how the Mueller investigation proceeds and to what extent it will continue to proceed.
You know, maybe, you know, Director Mueller will come up with a report and maybe there's no collusion. Maybe there's something else. Maybe there is nothing. But let him work. Let him do his case. And I think the president will do himself a favor and the American people a favor not to comment every other day and attack in another institution or another law enforcement entity or an attorney general or director of the FBI or whoever he's attacking for the day. Let Mr. Mueller finish his investigation, provide a report to the American people, and then we go from there. I mean, look, the way the president is acting, unfortunately, he's acting like a guilty guy who feels cornered. I think he should let the system work. And we go from there. He will be doing himself a favor, and he will be doing the American people and the United States of America with all its institutions a favor, and he will be doing the world and our allies a favor.
And you're not the only one who said that, Ali Soufan. Several Republican members of Congress, one in particular, Trey Gowdy, said this on the air not too long ago. That
because it's not a Republican versus Democrat, Carol. This is not a Republican versus Democrat. This is an American versus, unfortunately, I don't know how else to say it, the craziness that we're seeing today in Washington.
Well, turning now to the international front briefly before we close, because you're so eloquent about the many threats from Al-Qaeda, the so-called Islamic State. I wanted to turn briefly to Syria because, of course, we know Russia's involved there, backing Bashar al-Assad to the hilt. We witnessed a couple of weeks ago the U.S.-led missile strikes on chemical facilities in and around Damascus with the support of the U.K. and France. But what worries many more is the use of conventional weapons by Bashar al-Assad on his own people. And Mr. Trump said right before this horrible chemical weapons attack in Douma, he hinted at the potential withdrawal of about 2,000 troops, Ali Soufan, from northeast Syria. They're there to mop up the so-called Islamic State. They're not quite done yet, but he hinted at that. His, again, national security advisors are advising against that, but we don't know where that's going. How do you see that? Would that be sort of music to the ears of Bashar al-Assad, the Russians, and the Iranians, should the United States withdraw those few troops that are still at least in northeast Syria, and then perhaps, again, cede ground to the very groups that you write about that are on the rise?
First of all, let's talk about the strike that we did, you know, against the chemical facilities. It's important to do that and important to send a message from the United States and from our allies that the use of chemical weapons cannot happen without consequences. And I'm glad we did that. But it was a symbolic strike. We did before 59 missiles because he used also chemical weapons in a different area. So now we did about 100 missiles. But still, the strategy is still lacking. We have no strategy. And it seems we're conceding Syria to Russia and to Iran and to Turkey in so many different ways. I think the future of Syria is not going to be determined through Geneva anymore. It was very obvious that after our strike, the Russians are pulling away from Geneva, and they always wanted to pull away from Geneva anyway. That gave them an excuse to do it. But also at the same time, they are having their own thing going on with the summit between Rouhani, Erdogan, and Putin. And I think that summit will determine what's going on in Membij, for example, what's going on in Afrin, who's going to be in control of what. And if Erdogan gets to have some sort of political control, at least, or security control over these areas, I think they will negotiate Idlib with him. So I think there is a chess game going on. There is a small little mini Yalta going on. And unfortunately, it seems that our actions and the statements of our presidents indicate that we're pulling out of that. I give the same example as the Iraq war. In Iraq, we got rid of Saddam, and our policies resulted in giving Iraq to Iran on a silver platter. And our policy in Syria indicates that we're doing the same thing. We're giving Syria on the silver platter to Iran and Russia.
Indeed. I mean, it feels good to say we're going to bring our troops home, but once again, doing foreign policy through a domestic lens has its very serious strategic consequences.
And even if you want to do that, I mean, let's think about, okay, what is the serious consequences that you mentioned now for pulling out of Syria? How will that impact U.S. influence in the region? How will that impact our allies? How will that impact the Israelis or even the Gulf states? I mean, there are so many different things that we have to keep in mind. And we cannot even do that. We cannot even start thinking about that or engage in potential solution to Syria without a significant diplomatic strike. That's what needed. Not a military strike, a diplomatic strike. But look at the State Department. Most of the top positions in the State Department are empty. Look at the ambassadorships. I mean, my God, we don't have an ambassador in Saudi Arabia. We don't have an ambassador in Qatar. We don't have an ambassador in Egypt. We don't have an ambassador in South Africa. We don't have an ambassador in South Korea, in heaven's sake. So how are we going to engage diplomatically if we don't have the asset to utilize for a successful diplomatic engagement? You know, the military is the stick that we carry, but we cannot use it for everything. But also, I believe that when you have very good diplomats working in the field, we have the best military in the world, and we shouldn't be scared to use it. And all our enemies and adversaries should know that we are not scared to use our military power. But diplomacy goes first.
Diplomacy and values as well. And I want to end on that note, Ali Soufan, talking about Syria. It's so tragic because the largest flow of refugees since World War II, most of whom are coming out of Syria, they're innocent people. Maybe once in a while there's some kind of infiltration of a terrorist, but that does not tar and feather all these innocent people who are fleeing from the barbaric actions of Bashar al-Assad on the one hand or ISIS on the other. And that leads me to even a personal story on your part. I mean, you're an immigrant from Lebanon. You're a most upstanding U.S. citizen and an amazing professional. How do you see this reduction in the number of refugees now that this administration has basically telegraphed? We are now, according to the Trump administration, only admitting 45,000 refugees a year compared to double that in previous years. How does that advance our values and the integrity of our country?
Immigrants have been the backbone of America, and immigrants contribute to America's greatness. We call ourselves melting pot because of the people who came from all over the world to be part of this American dream, to be part of this great experience that's called America. And we're here in New York, and just downtown you can see the Statue of Liberty, which it's not only about freedom and liberty, but it's about welcoming people from all over the world to come and live in this shining city on the hill where there is freedom and liberty and equality. So I think Mr. Trump is trying to cater to a base that we talked about. People who are fearful that America is changing, you know, that the whiteness of America is getting a little bit tan. And I think they talk about immigrants from all countries except if they are from Europe. If they are from Europe, if they are from Norway, according to the president, they are okay. So I think this is a very concerning thing that definitely hits everything we stand for as America, and immigration and taking refugees and all these kind of things happens in a very secure way. That's why none of the terrorist attack that took a place here were people who basically immigrated or became refugees. Very, very, I think one or two attacks maybe, but to the most part, every day almost now, or every, not to exaggerate, every week at least, we have some crazy guy with an AR-15 killing people. And all of them were born here. They live here. You know, they are from one specific sex and they are from one specific race. And I think we have to keep that in mind, that we have a lot of threats here. We have a lot of problems here. And these problems are not what the ultra-right want us to think. Let's put it this way. If your grandfather's name is not Running Bear and your grandmother's name is not Pocahontas, you shouldn't be talking about immigrants.
Ali Soufan is a former supervisory FBI agent. He's an author and he's CEO of the Soufan Group. Ali Soufan, once again, thank you for your terrific insights. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in New York City and Washington. Our engineers were Daniel Brody and Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.